Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube. And on my last night in Havana, I was getting late dinner at an Italian place in the Vidado neighborhood. And a guy came in, and man, he looked a lot like Steve Coleman. and he was American, and he was carrying an alto case. And you would think, how many more clues did you need, Ken, that was Steve Coleman? But I thought, it's late, he's working, it's probably a long day, maybe he doesn't want to get into a random chat with somebody, so I didn't say anything. But I did tweet him and say, hey, were you in Havana on this night in this place? And he tweeted me back and said yes. And I thought to myself, you know, this is a sign. I should really see if Steve's available and be willing to talk with us a little bit about his work. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, how you doing? What were you doing there?
Just, you know, it was my second visit, and I just love it. I love the music of Cuba. I love the whole thing. And I was actually, the first time I went with a group. I went with Ned Sublett. You may know his name. He wrote a book, Cuba and Its Music. Mm-hmm. And he took us on a great tour. We went all over the West. We went to Matanzas. We went to a lot of places in Havana. But I wanted to go back by myself and see if I could navigate Havana by myself. It took me a couple of days to figure it out. But now I feel at home there. So that's what I was doing there. And I had remembered, and I knew that you'd been going to Cuba for a while. The first time I saw Steve was in the, I think it's the mid-90s. You were performing somewhere in Oakland, like in a loft.
In San Francisco?
In Oakland, for sure. Or maybe even Fruitvale. It was
called Upper Room.
Okay, that makes sense, because it was on the second floor.
Right.
And I know it sounds like, hey, I'm just saying this because I'm interviewing you, but that night sticks in my mind. That was some amazing music. I was trying to think of how I could express it, and it was kind of like being in a foundry where people were melting down metal and pouring it into different shapes, you know, and all that heat, you know, going on and all these things being formed. I mean, that's how I feel about it all these years later when I saw it. So I guess we were both at the West Coast in that time. Now, Steve, a lot of you know.
I wasn't actually out there then. We were doing a residency for like a month and a half. We did these residencies in the mid-90s where we came out 94, 95, and 96. We came out to California, to the Bay Area, and we stayed there for a while. We rented a house, and we sort of did these old-school-type residencies. And I've just recently started up doing them again the last 3 years. So that's what that was.
Okay, great. Okay. And by the way, you know, no matter how long Steve and I talk, we're not going to be able to even scratch the surface of the things that he's into. So I want to make sure everybody knows that they can go to m-bass.com, and there's interviews, there's essays Steve's written, there's dates that are coming up, places that he's going to be playing soon. It's one of the more interesting music sites that you're going to come across, so I really strongly recommend that. In fact, while we're talking about practicalities, you've got some gigs coming up. I know there's one coming up in New York City at the Gallery, Jazz
right.
Gallery.
The beginning of March.
Okay. Let me actually, I had all that up on the web. Let me go there right now. Because we have listeners all over the world, and we got a lot of people in New York. So that's Friday, March 3rd, March 4th at the Jazz Gallery.
Right.
You're doing something in Europe called Steve Coleman and Reflex European Tour. That's March 23rd through April 8th.
Right. Both of those are Reflex, the Jazz Gallery and the European Tour.
Oh, okay. Okay. So if you're in Europe, keep coming back to the site. I guess you'll have the more specific dates later.
Right. And they can also, there's a link there that they can click on the actual booking agent site, and they have details there too. But people can, you know, figure out, and they can always email if they have questions.
Great. And then if you're down in D.C. or Virginia or Maryland on April 22nd, Steve Coleman and Five Elements is going to be at the Library of Congress. That's April 22nd from 8 to 10 p.m. May 12th, where's the Walker Arts Center?
That's in Minneapolis.
Okay, great. So if you're in the Midwest, May 12th, 8 p.m., Walker Arts Center. And then, hey, the Vanguard, May 16th through the 21st.
Everybody knows where the Vanguard is.
yeah. And then back to Europe.
We'll probably be doing a live recording at the Vanguard this time, which will be our first time doing that.
Oh, okay. Great. So, yeah, New Yorkers, mark your calendar. That's going to be good. You're going to be there a whole week, so probably two sets a night. And
right, exactly.
Oh, I love that. So I think a lot of people already know who Steve is. Some people might not. some people might know him and not know his background. So I just want to go quickly on the early years so people understand where he's coming from. So Steve's from Chicago, and you had a lot of early inspiration and guidance from Sonny Stitt and Von Freeman. Is that right?
Yeah, Sonny Stitt, Von Freeman, and another guy named Bunky Green also.
Oh, Bunky Green, of course, of course. And yeah, we do. We play a lot of Sonny Stitt videos on Jazz on the Tube. I think a lot of people don't grasp how amazing, what an amazing musician he was. And yeah. Von, of course, was amazing. We, for years, we were telling everybody, get to the new apartment lounge, just do it, go and hear this great master. And when I finally got to see him a lot, he was already getting on in years. I think he was already up to 80. So he didn't have a lot of his physical vitality that he had as a younger man that you can see in videos and stuff. But the artistry was just incredible. I could say a funny story. Yeah, go ahead.
He's probably my biggest living influence on me of the people who I saw live, you know. I mean, and I made countless audio recordings, you know, these little cassette recordings and reel-to-reel recordings at the time of him in the when I was first starting out, the 70s and late 70s, early 80s, mid to late 70s and early 80s, I made countless recordings. And then I would come home and I would just study this stuff. My mother thought I was
crazy. Oh, wow, okay. I knew you were inspired and you had connection with him. I didn't realize how close a disciple, a student you were of what he was doing. Wow.
Yeah,
when I hear him play.
He never formally gave me any lessons, but I studied him like crazy.
Yeah, yeah. When I hear him play, I hear everything. I hear Lester Young. I hear Charlie Parker. I hear him. I hear the whole world when I heard him play. It was amazing. For about a year, I managed, I did the day-to-day management of a label called India Navigation. And,
Eco Freeman before you put on.
Yeah, exactly. And so the story I wanted to tell you and the listeners, and I know you'll relate to this right away, is so at some point way back, there was an interview with Chico, and Chico was asking his dad, "Dad, how do you get that sound?" And his father looked at him and said, "I'm not telling you. It took me 40 years to figure out. You figure something out, you know?" And look, can we talk a little about that? I don't know how many people appreciate the challenge of finding, developing, growing, evolving, discovering, inventing a sound. And how important is that in the development of a musician?
Well, for me, it's everything. All of the older people who I talked to early on, you know, people like Max Roach, Ray Brown, Von Freeman, you know, Sonny Stitt, everybody, Bunky Green, all those guys, you know, I talked to a lot of guys, Clifford Jordan, they all told me the same thing, which was that you have to find out your way of approaching this music. You know, Max Roach would tell me, you know, he said, you can't do what we did. I don't even want to do what we did again. he said, you got to find your own way. And they both told me the same thing. Him and Von, Max Roach and Von both told me the same thing, which was very interesting. They told me that it doesn't matter whether we like what you're doing. You see that, you know, they knew I respected them and everything. They said, it doesn't matter whether we like what you're doing. What's important is, do you dig it? You know, he said, what I got is immaterial. You know, I might not even know what you're trying to do, but you have to know. And so this set up very early in me that it's about listening to your inner voice and following your own intuition and your own inclination and your own affinities and everything, and just going, you know, going where that leads you, to trust yourself, basically, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the whole thing is to be able to, how well do you know yourself? You know, I mean, you have to go inside. And, you know, this is what led me into a lot of meditation stuff and all this Eastern philosophy and all this kind of stuff, because I was trying to figure this out when I was younger. Well, how do you listen to yourself? You know, so.
Yeah, because it's something you have to discover. And I guess there's really two challenges. There's one to attain fluency, which is just hard work, you know.
Yeah,
really knowing your way around the instrument, knowing
the
all the things
part
that can be done. But then beyond that alone just gets you to the starting gate.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if I would call it a starting gate, because some people, that's the end for them. But I mean, the technical part is difficult. It's not easy, but it's easier than the first thing you mentioned, which is finding yourself and finding your own voice and everything. To me, that's much harder. of the two things. The technical thing is sort of a just, you know, practical, you know, just repetition, practice hard, work hard, and I know people who are music students who are not even close to finding themselves, but who are very proficient technically, you know. So you can just tell by the numbers of people who have the technical thing down versus the number of people who sound like themselves, and that tells you which one is easier.
And you made a, because of the exposures you had and your own sensibilities, you knew that that potential existed, and you went for it from a very early part of your development as a musician.
Yeah, I happen to think that everybody has something personal, you know, and most people don't connect to it and everything, but I think that we're all unique, you know, just like plants, snowflakes, and everything else, you know. Everybody has something unique in them. Whether they can communicate with that and get to that, now that's the trick, you know.
Right. And by definition, nobody can tell you, no one can give you a manual and say, okay, here's the manual of you, just start at page one and it'll all be figured out.
Exactly. They can inspire you, but you have to do it yourself.
Yep. So to continue with your development as a musician, you know, like so many musicians, you don't really want to be called a jazz musician. I mean, for commercial purposes, you know, you kind of, there are jazz clubs like the Village Vanguard, and there's jazz labels, and so that makes things a little easier to just navigate. But you don't think of yourself as, oh, I'm a jazz musician, and that's it.
No, and most of the people who I admire, you know, the John Coltranes and people like that, they didn't think of themselves like that either. I'm not just imitating them, but I'm just saying that common sense would tell you that all these people were pretty open to everything that was happening in the world. So to just put a simple label on it like that is, you know, it's for commercial reasons that people do that, mainly. You know,
yeah, it's a handy thing for, okay, you know, what section of the record, you know, when there were record stores, what section of the record store do we go to if we're looking for a John Coltrane album? Well, it's handy that there's a jazz section, but that shouldn't be the end of the story. That's just sort of the beginning of understanding who John Coltrane was and what he did and what he developed.
This doesn't have anything to do with music. When you go in the grocery store, right, there's the vegetable section, the meat section, so it's the way that society works, period. And music just happens to be a subset of that. You know.
Exactly. We need some commercial order so we know the tomatoes are over there and the milk somewhere else. Otherwise, we'd be wandering around the store. We'd never get anything done. You wrote a beautiful essay. It's on the website. I want to encourage everybody to read it. It's called, let's see, The Dozens, I think. The Dozens.
The Parker thing, yeah.
Yeah, and you I guess had some editorial help with a guy named Ted Pankin. And for people who, you know, love and admire Charlie Parker, when you read this, it's going to take it to a whole other level of admiration and understanding. And so that's on the M-Bass website under the essay section. I really encourage everybody to check that out. And I want to talk about a particular track number six you talked about. It's called Mango Mang. I'm not sure how you pronounce the...
Mango Mengue.
And it's Charlie Parker with Machito.
Right.
And Mario Bauza and a whole bunch of other pretty big band. And here's why I want to talk to you about this. I forgot who wrote this, and I'm glad I forgot who wrote it, because this other thing, because I didn't agree with it when I first heard it. And it was somebody talking about Charlie Parker and his interaction with Cuban percussion. And this guy said, well, Charlie Parker didn't really know what was going on with that, and he just sort of wrote on top of it and really wasn't paying much mind to what the percussionists were doing. And I thought, are you really? This intensely serious man was just fooling around and wasn't really paying attention? This guy with a perfect rhythmic sense and sensibility was not interacting with those drummers? I can hardly believe that. And so in your review, and I know you don't have the review in front of you, but you talk about the things that you heard in Parker's performance with Machito's orchestra, that in fact you heard that he was hooked up with what was going on around him. He just wasn't running his thing on top of what they were doing randomly.
Well, I can go on this for a long time. It's pretty deep. First of all, Mario Bowser, who played with Dizzy, Mario Bowser played trumpet, I believe, and he was in the trumpet section with Dizzy and Cab Calloway's band, and that's how they met before Dizzy, you know, struck out on his own. And so when Dizzy was ready to investigate Afro-Cuban music, he called Mario and said, well, you know, who can you hook me up with? You know, I want to check this stuff out, you know, and I want to maybe start incorporating it in what I'm doing and everything. And so Mario said, well, I have the perfect cat for you, but he don't speak no English, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Dizzy said, well, that's okay. We can speak music, you know. And so he hooked him up with Chano Pozo, you know, who's a great, well, everybody should know who Chano Pozo is. If not, check him out. And so let me see. Hold on a second. I just...
I know when Pozo, by the time Pozo made it to New York from Havana, he was already deeply, deeply accomplished musician. And I know that he wrote, helped write Manteca with Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah, he was, Pozo was deep. He wrote his own compositions. He was Abacua, which I don't know if people know what that is, but I mean, he was deep off into like a lot of the folkloric religious aspects of the music and everything. And so he brought all of that, you know. Dizzy didn't hire a lot of drummers, but he hired him, and he sort of built some things around him. And Chano was doing all these chants and things like that. You can hear him doing Abacua chants and stuff in the middle of Dizzy's thing on some of the live recordings that they did back then, you know, and it was great. So Dizzy said he would sit in the back of the bus and hang out with Chano and ask him about rhythms and you know, have him beat out certain rhythms and things like that. He would ask him a lot of questions. Even though Chano didn't speak English, they managed to talk. And I know you can do that because I've done it many times myself. I've talked to, you know, I just got through hanging out with this great percussionist named Yoraldi, who plays with Chucho Valdez in Itakere now. And he doesn't really speak English. And we, you know, we hang out and we talk about music and we talk about, you know, the different kind of rhythmic patterns and things like that. So I know it's possible. I do it in Brazil too, with guys who don't speak English, you know, but when you have music's the language, you can accomplish a lot, actually, you know. And so anyway, Dizzy mentioned that he didn't know how much Charlie Parker had actually studied rhythms and things like that. But Mario Bowser said in the interview that he thought that Charlie Parker's playing, out of all the African-American guys, was the cat that fit the best with what they were doing, with what the Cubans were doing. You know, he said the way Charlie Parker played, it just fit like a glove, you know. And so I tried to get to what that is on the website. I've even had conversations with older musicians about this, and the cat who I've talked to the most about is probably Billy Hart, who's a drummer. And Billy Hart said that, I mean, I know you know, but I'm just saying this for the audience. And Billy Hart said that there's a lot of, like, sort of hidden clave-type things in African-American music that a lot of people don't hear because they just hear the music in a different way. But it's in there, and it's connected to the music in the Caribbean, places like Cuba, Puerto Rico, Haiti, you know, more than what people know, you know. But it's not everywhere, you know. It's not the music that people call jazz. This is one of the reasons why I don't like to use that term. It's really a very wide area. And not everybody is, on the surface, they may seem like they're doing the same thing, but not everybody's doing the same thing. You know, there's big differences in what different people are doing. And the biggest difference, I think, is rhythmically. Most of these guys who are coming out of Berkeley and playing these schools and stuff like that are not rhythmically doing the same thing that Charlie Parker was doing, even though they may think that they are. They may think that they're swinging and this or that or whatever, but they're not doing the same thing because it's not just about walking bass and somebody riding on a cymbal. It's more subtle than that. And so I try to get to that in that Charlie Parker article. I try to talk a lot about the rhythmic aspect because I don't hear people talking about it. And, you know, I don't know if it's too cryptic or what, but in that composition is what made me want to go to Cuba, in fact. You know,
kidding.
That you mentioned. Yeah, I was like, man, what is this? Because I had heard a lot of Charlie Parker, but I had never heard him in that setting. And I wanted to explore that. I wanted to know, well, what is this? You know, I mean, I just couldn't figure out what was happening. I really studied that composition a lot, you know.
That's great. And for people that want to follow up on that, luckily there's a YouTube, somebody uploaded the track from YouTube, and you can listen to it too. And it just seems to be a blindness about the nature of the communication between the Cubans and the beboppers. I mean, people do talk about it. You know, they talk about, you know, Dizzy a little bit and Manteca and, you know, some of the other stuff that happened. But I think there must have been a lot more that happened than got recorded.
Well, there was more that didn't get recorded, too. I mean, Bird said that somebody interviewed him about how those recordings happened. And Charlie Parker said, you know, we were hanging out with these guys for a long time before this even came about. He said we would go and sit in with them, and they would come and sit in with us. And he said that, you know, there was this sort of dialogue that was happening already in like the late 40s, you know, with some of the Cuban musicians and everything. And they just it just happened that some of it was recorded. But he said there was a lot more that was happening, you know, just spontaneously. And I know as a musician, the people don't realize this because they live by recordings, but the majority of the stuff for us happens when things aren't recorded, by far.
Right.
You know, the most interesting things and the majority of things that happen are the things that aren't recorded in somebody's private house or get together somewhere that happens spontaneously. You know, there's all these things that happen. You know, on my Facebook page, I just posted this sort of spontaneous thing that happened in Matanzas, you know, where I started jamming with one guy on the street and these other guys joined in and everything. That kind of stuff happens all the time. You know, but it's not recorded. And people think, oh, I love this record that you put out. And I'm thinking, that record, that's not really what's happening. You know, I mean, what's happening is all this other stuff that's going on. When I got together with this South Indian Madungan player or this over here or this over, you know, I mean, but nobody can talk about that because it's not documented. But that's the majority of a musician's life, you know, by far.
Right. The recording part is just the tip of the iceberg. And I once somebody, it was a singer, I can't remember her name, and I think she put it well. She goes, the record's just my calling card. You know, it's just my business card so that you come and hear us play live, so that you'll come and check us out. It's not meant to be like, you don't just stare at somebody's business card to understand them. That's just the beginning. That's the door opener. That's the, hey, here we are, and come and see some more. Part of the goal of, go ahead, please, yeah.
No, I'm just saying, it's just a snapshot of a moment. People forget that. It's just a snapshot of a moment. You're in a studio for a certain period of time, and it's a snapshot of that. But we play every day in all kinds of situations. I mean, if you were to put out everything that Coltrane ever did, I mean, the market would be flooded with, you know, Coltrane stuff, you know. I mean, it's a lot out here now, but it's nowhere near as much as what he played. You know, my recordings of Vaughn, for example, I recorded him every week for years. And I've got like a big giant archive of recordings, you know. I mean, and people say, where can I go hear Vaughn? Which record can I get? And I don't even know what to tell them because, I mean, for me, it's about all those nights I saw him, you know. I mean, you know, it's not about, no record comes close to those, you know.
Yep. I mean, I'll tell you, for people that, you know, are trying to wrap their minds around this, I had this experience where one night I was helping Ornette. He had all his collection, all his tapes that he owned of his own work were over at the Artist House label, not Artist House on Prince Street, but Artist House, the label. And he wanted to move them out there. So he and I went with a friend of mine and we moved them. I'm going to tell you guys, it was a big pile. It took us a long time. And Ornette told me, he said there's stuff, there's him, Cecil Taylor and Bud Powell on a tape, just fooling around. He said there was a lot of stuff with him and Coltrane. You know, not only is the recording the tip of the iceberg, but and the recording is the rarest thing that happens, but there's a lot of recordings people don't even know exist that are out there that we may never even hear, you know. So it's an interesting world. That's why we have this site called Jazz on the Tube, and we have 2,000 plus videos of everybody, you know, from you know, Louis Armstrong, you know, all the way up to, you know, everybody we can get in there. And the reason we did it was, first of all, I think it's important for people to see the music. I don't know, you know, people might say, well, it's a auditory music. Why do you need to see it? And I don't really have an answer other than that I feel you need to see it to really understand it fully. And the other thing is always to encourage people, go out and see it live. It's a totally different and important experience to see it live and to be in the room when it's happening. Because, a lot of magic happens that you'll never see if you're just on here listening to recordings. So it's so interesting that this particular track with Charlie Parker got you interested in Cuba. Now, I know that your trip to Cuba is a subset of a larger set of trips that you've taken. I'm going to call them research trips around the world, and they're not, I mean, if my understanding is correct, it's not just limited to your interest in music, it's your interest in everything. I would call it maybe meta physical. In other words, you know, you're tending to all the physical stuff, but you're also interested in, okay, what's beyond the physical stuff, the obvious stuff that we see. And so you've been to, we talked earlier before the recording started, you've been to Ghana, you've been to Brazil. So what, can you tell us a little bit about what, besides the obvious musical reasons to go to those places, what's driving you to visit these places repeatedly?
Okay. Before that, I'm going to briefly touch on the last thing you said about recordings and live and all that.
Okay.
I look at it like it's the difference between listening to a conversation of a speech, having a conversation with somebody on the phone, or having a conversation with somebody in person. You know, all those are very different experiences. Of course, the in-person thing, you're getting gestures, facial expressions, you know, I mean, little things that you're picking up that you would not necessarily get on the phone. And with the speech, there's no interaction at all, you know. So, I mean, I just wanted to mention that anyway. I mean,
That's a great analogy. And then there's the issue of a whole bunch of people in a room talking together,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That's a whole other dynamic, you know, party.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, on to your question, I started traveling to all these places probably in 93. You know, I always wanted to do it, but I didn't have the money to do it and didn't really have the methodology either, you know, until around 93, I stabilized myself enough that I could do it. I lived in New York prior to 1991. I lived in New York for 13 years, and New York's a very expensive place, you know, and I wasn't playing any kind of popular music and everything. So I was, most of the time there, I was barely keeping my head above water. I mean, because the bills were so much and everything that I was just staying in one spot. I was treading water. I was working more, but, you know, expenses as you move, you know, different places, expenses pile up and everything. So I told myself that I wanted to get a cheaper place and reduce my overhead because I figured that, I mean, Henry Threadgill and a bunch of older guys told me that, you know, the main thing you got to do as a creative musician is reduce your overhead because you're not going to become rich, music, you know. So because you're not going to become rich, if you reduce, you know, what you have to pay out, that's like making more money, you know, in a sense. And I said, okay, that makes a lot of sense, you know. And I saw these guys playing this really strange music, but they were able to survive. So I looked at them, you know. I mean, people like Cecil Taylor, Ornette, all these people, I looked at them very carefully because I was like, how can somebody play music like this and still survive? I mean, because this stuff is, you know, the most uncommercial stuff I've ever heard, you know. I mean,
right,
know?
Right.
And so I looked at those guys very carefully, and I followed a lot of the lead. So anyway, I finally bought some property in 91, and once I got back on my feet again, because it took everything I had to buy the property, it was about 2 years before I got back on my feet again. But then my overhead was reduced greatly from moving right outside of New York, you know. And then I was able to say, okay, now I can concentrate on going to some of these other places that I know that they won't necessarily call my band to play because the infrastructure is not set up that way in Ghana, India, Cuba, some of these places, you know. So I'm just going to go. And I realized that Coltrane and Miles, for example, as far as I know, they never went to Africa. They never went to, I mean, Train never went to India. He never went to all these places that he was interested in. He always studied them from a distance. And I said, well, if they didn't go and they were gigging their asses off, then what makes me think I'm going to go? You know what I mean? It's a gig. And then I looked at, you know, Randy Weston, people like Don Cherry and people like this who did go to these places, and they just went on their own. They just made it happen, you know. And so I used them as models and said, okay, I'm just going to go and make it happen, you know. So my first trip was to Ghana in the 93, going into 94. The first 2-3 weeks was a disaster because I didn't know what I was doing, and I was, you know, couldn't find any musicians. I couldn't find my way around. I sort of went cold, you know. But I learned a lot from doing that. And my subsequent trips, I didn't make the same mistakes, you know. And so,
right.
You know, so that was, you know, I've been to Ghana, I've been to Egypt, I've been to, you know, India several times, Indonesia a bunch of times, places, you know, like Caribbean, you know, different places in the Caribbean and South America and stuff like that. And it's always the same thing because my main interest was when I used to play initially at Von Freeman Sessions a long time ago before I even moved to New York, I would start playing. And there would be some guy sitting in front of me saying, blow your horn, young man, tell your story, you know, tell me about it, all this kind of stuff, you know, I mean, you know. And so I was wondering when I was younger, I was like, tell what story? What is this that they're talking, you know, I mean, I play saxophone. What kind of story am I supposed to be telling, you know? And I would listen to older musicians, like interviews of Lester Young and stuff like that, and they would say, man, Prez, there's this great saxophone player, blah, blah, blah. And parents will say, yeah, but what's his story? And I was like, story? What story? You know, I was trying to I was trying to figure this out, you know. And so I don't know. That was the main thing, is that I was just trying to figure out, well, what is this telling a story with sounds, especially with nonverbal music, you know,
sure.
Music that have words, you know. I was trying to figure this out for a long time. And so that's, even till today, that was my main thrust, was seeing how humans communicate using sound. How can they communicate? Of course, it takes me into languages and stuff there too, but that's a more obvious area. You know, I mean, languages where you have these agreed upon meanings for words and syntax and all this kind of stuff. Music is a primarily symbolic language, and so it's a different story, you know. So that's the thrust of my research, is trying to figure out, you know, the details of how different people in different places, you know, and now and in the past, you know, because I do a lot of historical study too, how they use music, sounds, particularly nonverbal music, to communicate. And how can you do that? And how can you communicate? And what can you communicate? And can people understand it? And all these questions, you know.
Gotcha. And, you know, and not to take this too far afield, but one of the things that you feel that you discovered, that there was some connection between the music of Egypt and the music of West Africa, ancient music of Egypt, and the music that you can hear in Africa, and then also partially in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, it's hard to, it's really, talking about music's a hard thing, but clearly music is a thing, and somehow without words, without pictures, it conveys things, and those things can be transferred from person to person, from country to country. There's some kind of understanding that gets transferred, but because it's not verbal and we can't maybe pin it down with mathematical or verbal precision, it's a little harder to express. So after traveling to all these places, you also had on your agenda to get to Cuba. And how did that – so you said that it was the Charlie Parker album that got you thinking, I better see what they're doing down there. Can you talk about your first trip there? And you, I know on your first trip you went to Matanzas,
right.
And a lot of people listening may not know. Oh well, what's Matanzas? Maybe you could tell people why that's such an important place in Cuba and why you went there first and what you discovered when you were there.
I went there first because I knew right off the bat that I was more interested in the folkloric traditions. You know, they had more of a storytelling aspect to them, and I wanted to see. I knew the popular music was based on that, you know, that there was this folkloric base under everything, just like it is here in the United States. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that, but I consider, for example, things like the blues and bluegrass and all those. I consider those folkloric forms, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and the other music is sort of based on that, you know, a lot of it, you know, with the exception of the music that's like European art music, you know, that's influenced by Beethoven and all that. And so I was more interested in that because I wanted to get the foundational stuff, you know, happening, you know. So and then everybody told me before I went there, they say, well, if you want to do that, Matanzas is the place, you know, because, I mean, Matanzas is the name means something like killing or killing grounds or something like this. It's a strange name. And it's the place in Cuba where it was the biggest slave port where most of the slaves went. The equivalent place in Brazil would be Bahia. That was the place where most of the slaves went in Brazil. More slaves went to Brazil than anywhere else in the so-called New World.
Mm-hmm.
But Cuba was also a place that a massive amount of slaves went there, some of them to stay in Cuba, some of them to get transferred somewhere else. And Matanzas was the biggest port for slaves in Cuba. And so it's just really a lot of black people, you know. It's very kind of African kind of vibe to the place, you know. And so I went there first because everybody told me that was the bed of the folkloric stuff, that if I was interested in the folkloric stuff, I should go to Matanzas first. You know?
Okay.
So that's why I went there.
But it's challenging. You know, for instance, I mean, going to Havana is a little challenging by itself, but Havana's got some infrastructure for tourists and so on. But, you know, Matanzas is not even a tourist city within Cuba. I mean, a lot of people in Cuba aren't even going to Matanzas, so it's tricky to get, you know, not to get there physically, to get there is not a problem, but places to stay, hooking up with people, it's a little different than Havana.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's very different than Havana. I mean, it's like going down to Mississippi or something. It's more rural, you know.
Right, and that's the area where there still are huge sugar farms, and that's where a lot of the sugar trade was, and that's why so much of the travel, the importing of, you know, kidnapped people came through Matanzas. So, and I think this is something people may not know about Cuba. It's kind of really kind of helps people understand Cuba. The U.S. actually outlawed importing kidnapped people in around 1810. Like, you couldn't bring new people from Africa to the United States after around 1810.
Mm-hmm.
You could there still was a slave trade and all that.
Yeah, definitely.
But it was people that were already in Virginia and Maryland. They'd already been there for maybe some generations, and then they were moved to the Delta. But in Cuba, they were still bringing people straight from Africa as late as, I think, 1890.
Yeah. I mean, the Caribbean is deep, you know. I mean, like what happened in Haiti with the revolution, which happened in the time of Napoleon, basically. You know, I feel like the Western countries wanted to make an example of Haiti because they didn't want this to spread, you know, this idea, this notion of a black nation gaining their own independence. You know, they didn't want that idea to spread. The United States was against it, and the reason why Haiti's in the condition it's in today, I mean, besides the debt, illegal debt that it basically owes to France, you know, is because they wanted to make an example of this country that was like the first, you know, as far as I know, the first country of black people to gain their independence.
I think that tendency extends right to the present day. I think they're still trying to make an example of Haiti, and I maybe they're afraid of Haiti. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know
what it is. I mean, but you know, obviously racism and all that's a part of it. You know, but
there's a lot of power. Have you ever had a chance to go to Haiti?
I wanted to go to Haiti before I went to Cuba, but I mean, I had my ticket and everything, man. And the day before I was getting ready to get on the plane, some American got kidnapped and beheaded, and I was like, oh, next, you know.
Yeah.
Me and the dancer in my group, we had literally had our tickets in our hands, and we were on our way to go there to study, you know.
Oh.
And that one incident changed our minds, and we went to Cuba instead.
I know that Ned Sublette, who's you know, he's been to Cuba, oh man, 40 times or something. He had a Cuba record label. He's very plugged in down there. He says Haiti's a whole different level of challenge to travel.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. If you think Cuba's rough. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, the creative energy from out of Haiti is huge. We just don't get to experience it because of all the political things that go on. I mean, a lot of people don't know that the reason New Orleans is the way it is because after the revolution, a lot of people left Haiti. And some of them ended up in New Orleans, and the population of New Orleans doubled, like, overnight with all these people. And Haiti had a really well-developed tradition of music. They had conservatories. They had an opera house. They had, you know, they took music to a very high level, and, you know, that mixed with the people that were already there, and that's how you got New Orleans. There's a drummer, by the way, just not to go off too far, but Bobby Sanabria. There's a video of him on YouTube sliding straight from a traditional clave right into a second line street parade beat. And you it's suddenly completely clear how close they really are. It just took someone who had the understanding to demonstrate it. So you got to Matanzas, and, you know, traveling in these countries is tricky. It's not like going to Cozumel or Barbados or something. I mean, it's not set up to make it easy to get around. It's tricky. So you had the logistical challenges, obviously, when you got there. Who did you hook up with, and what kind of things were you getting involved in and learning about? And
well, because of my Ghana trip, you know, like I said, I wasted so much time. I was in Ghana for 5 weeks, and I wasted 2.5 weeks just trying to figure out how to get where I was going. I went to Ghana to go specifically to this very specific village called Yindi, which is in what they call northern Ghana. You know, I think it's central Ghana, but they call it northern Ghana. But Yindi is near a town called Tamale. And I went there to go to this village. I knew about the village. I read about it. I read about these drummers who got up. I'm going to get to your Cuba thing, but these drummers got up every day and they beat out on the drums the lineage of the kings of the tribes and told their stories and their exploits and everything, but not with words, just on the drums. And so I had to see this, you know, because this was like the main area of my study, you know. And when I was real little, you know, I'd seen, you know, what everybody else saw, Tarzan movies, you know, here comes the white man, people beating on the drums and stuff like that, you know. So I didn't know how that worked, you know, and I thought, okay, well, what is this? Is some kind of Morse code or something? I mean, how does this work? I want to know the mechanics of how it works. And so I wanted to go to this village, talk to these drummers through translators, of course, talk to the elders of the village and everything, and I had a certain series of questions that I wanted to ask them, and I wanted to do my own research myself, not just read a book about it, you know, or buy a record or whatever, right. You know. So it took me, like I said, 2.5 weeks to get to this village. It was all kind of mishaps and stuff that occurred along the way, you know, bribing police, all kinds of stuff. But the bottom line is that I ended up in this village, which was a real village. No Western structures, no hotels, no, you know, huts. I mean, it was, and I get there and my manager's with me and she's like, where the hell are we supposed to sleep?
So right.
It's a long story. I could tell you another time. But the bottom line is that I got to, you know, see the drummer who got up every morning. I got to talk to the elders. I did the whole thing, but it took a long time. So, and I did a lot of research. And then I went to the University of Lagoon and all this kind of stuff and saw, got a lot of stuff of African professors writing about African music that I had never seen over here. A lot of material where they had their own musicologists doing their own research, and it was much more valuable than the Westerners. Musicologist, you know, that's what I found. I found some incredible stuff there. This work by this guy named Willie Anku, for example, A-N-K-U. And he died. I met him a little bit after that, but he passed recently in a car accident. A long time ago, actually. And so he has some, you can search him on the web. He wrote some great things about African music and the language in the music and how it relates to the rhythms and all this kind of stuff. And I learned a lot from reading his works and from talking to him. I learned a lot about the music and everything. So anyway, when I decided to go to Cuba, I said, okay, I'm not going to make the same mistake because I didn't know, I wanted to dive right into what I was doing. And I didn't do that in Ghana because I wasted so much time just dealing with the infrastructure and the situation, you know. And so I hired some people who did a tour, something like the tour you went on, you know. They were called Caribbean.
Okay.
They were called Caribbean Music and Dance. And they took Americans to Cuba to do this sort of popular learn salsa thing, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And so I contacted them. I said, look, I'm telling you right from the outset, I'm not interested in attending your classes. I'm not remotely interested in your tour. You know, I just want to use you as a liaison to get to certain people. And I gave them the list of people who I wanted to get into. They said, yeah, we know all these people. I was like, fine. And so they were like, well, we can help with your project. I was like, I don't need that. I just need you to introduce me to these people, to set up my hotels and stuff or whatever before I get there, and that's all I want you to do. I want you to stay out of the way as much as possible and just introduce me to these people. And they said, well, you're going to need somebody to help you translate and everything. I said, I got that covered, you know. And what happened was that I met a guy a little before that named Josvani Terry, who's a professional musician now living in New York. You know, Josvani, his name looks like Y-O-S-V-A-N-Y. And so I met him, and he spoke English, and he knew about my music, and his father was a folkloric music, and he knew about Cuban music. And as soon as I met him, I said, man, I'm coming to Cuba. He said, okay, come on, you know. And I said, look, you might not understand this, but you're going to be my Mario Bowser. That's what I told him. You know? And he was like, who the hell is Mario Bowser? You know, I was like, you're going to be my musical bridge, you know. I mean, you know.
Nice.
That's exactly how it worked out. So he was like, I had him on board. He lived in Havana. He went to Matanzas with me and everything. He did all the translations and everything, and he knew the music. That was the important thing. This tourist group didn't really know the music. They sure. thought they that they did, you know. I mean, and this guy was a musician. He played saxophone. He knew the rhythms and all this kind of stuff, and he knew a little bit about my music. So, I could talk to him about what I was trying to do. And so anyway, we made a DVD about all of this. You know, the trip to Cuba, subsequent trips to Senegal and to Egypt and to India and all this kind of stuff, and travels in America and Europe. And all of this is on a DVD. It's called Elements of One. And I have a site. It looks just like the other site, m-base.com, only it's .net on the end instead of .com. It's a site mainly for musicians, but other people are on there too. And it's you need to register, but registration is free. And on this site, a lot of video material. It's sort of like what you were talking about your site. There's a whole lot of video. See, because on mbase.com, it's more of an information thing. But n-bass.net has all the material, all the music, all the recordings, all the video recordings, all of that stuff. You know, has a lot of stuff and instructional videos, all kinds of things like that. And it's interactive. We do conference calls every month and, you know, people talk. And it's like, we got 3,000 people on that site from all over the world, you know.
Oh, it's that's great. Wow.
It's not huge like, you know, it's not like YouTube or one of these things like this, but it's 3,000 serious people, serious about creative music. You know, it's not so commercial oriented, you know. And so that DVD is available on that. You can download it on that site. You know, I mean, it's available on that site. You know, we have small fees for to run the site and keep stuff on the servers and everything. But that's it. It's not a big money making operation and everything. And so a lady approached me a year before I went to Cuba in Toronto. You mentioned Toronto. She approached me in Toronto and she said, look, I'm a filmmaker and I want to follow you around the world and film you. And I didn't take her serious. I was like, yeah, okay. You know, right. You know, she was like, no, I'm serious. I want to follow you everywhere you're going and film it for like, you know, 2-3 years. And I was like, fine, I'm going to Cuba. You want to follow me there? She said, yeah. I was like, now, it's not going to be, because I was making an exploratory trip to Cuba before I went down there with my group. I was like, the conditions are not going to be great. I'm telling you this right now. I mean, can you handle it? You know? And she's like, yeah, I can handle it. I'm a trooper and everything, you know. Man, we got the Matanzas. They had us sleeping like next to a pigsty.
Exactly. Yeah, it's country. It's country.
but she,
wow.
She's a trooper. She went to Africa with me. She went to India. She went to Egypt. You know, she went to all these places, and some of them were not comfortable, you know, but she traveled with me because she was very serious about documenting this stuff. So she has the best documentation because, like you said, videos speak louder than even music, you know. She's got me playing inside the Great Pyramid. I mean, I bribed the guards and got in there in the middle of the night and stayed in there for like 4 hours, you know, playing and, you know, I mean, by myself, you know, I mean, and she followed me when I did that and everything, you know. So it's a lot of stuff that, you know, a lot of different stories and stuff like that I could tell you about India, about Africa, and these different places. But she went with me to Cuba a couple of times, you know, and she was on that first trip to Matanzas, too.
That's, you know, great. So. And so there's a film about this. I'm actually, while we're talking, I'm registering for your site for everybody again. No, because it's incredible. m-bass.net. And, you know, you were one of the early people ever, but especially among musicians, to really understand what the web was going to, what some of the potential the web had.
Yeah,
I was dealing with things better.
I was dealing with the web before they called it the web. I mean, you know, it was the late. I got into computers in '85. That's how early I got to it. You know, somebody told me about. I was looking for a 4-track tape recorder, and some guy told me, he said, "Well, you know, you should get a computer because with a computer you can record more than 4 tracks." And I was like, a computer? What is that? You know, it was an old TV show. I mean, I'm pretty old, but it was an old TV show in the 60s called Lost in Space. And I used to watch all these programs, Lost in Space, Star Trek, all this stuff. So when he said computer, I thought robot, because that's what I thought a computer was, a robot, you know. And he's like, no, man, they look more like typewriters. And, you know, they got these micro and home computers were just starting to come out where you could buy, like, a home computer. You know, my first computer was a Commodore 64. And so I got the thing, and then I found out that you could create on it, that you can make your own programs, and that made me go crazy. I was like, wow, you mean I can create programs myself? I don't even have to go to the store and buy stuff, you know? And so, and then Chico Freeman hit me to electronic mail. That's what email was called in the beginning, you know? And right. He hit me and everything. So anyway, all this goes on is long story. To make a long story longer, in 1994, a guy at Berkeley took me and Vijay Iyer, pianist, you know, in a room at UC Berkeley, and he said, I want to show you guys something. And he showed me for the first time what was called the World Wide Web at that time. You know, now people don't use that term, but it was a prototype of Netscape, which is an internet browser, you know. And there was nothing on the web but nerds, a few schools, and a few scientific institutions. There was no commercial presence whatsoever. It was completely empty. You know, I mean, there was none of this .com. I mean, you know, none of this stuff that you see today. You know, there was no commercials, no pop-ups with commercials. There was no Google. There was none of that. It was just this very, very bare interface that kept crashing. And so me and Vijay looked at each other. And so Vijay said, well, I'm not that impressed. You know, the thing doesn't hardly work. And I looked at him and said, are you kidding? You see the idea here? If this thing catches on, this is it, buddy. Everything's going to change. That's what I said back then, you know. And so that was my first introduction. And then the guy told me, he said, I'm showing you this because I want to build your website. And I said, you want to build our website? He said, yeah. And I said, and what do we have to pay you? He said, nothing. I'll do it for free. An alarm went off in my head, you know, because I know nobody does nothing for free in this country. I know that,
Right.
And so it's like, this guy wants to build something called a web page for me for free. I need to get some books and find out what this thing is, because there's a reason why he wants to do this, you know. And so the short story is that at the time, people were trying to get real estate on the internet. They were trying to be the first to, and to attract people to their site. You needed something to bring them to the site. And he was trying to use our name and get a bunch of people like us so that he can attract. He wanted to be the first pioneer kind of thing, Lewis and Clark, right? He wanted to be the first, And so I thought, well, if he could build a website, I could buy some books on HTML and build a site myself. I don't need this guy to build my site. So I went out and bought some books and started reading them. Everything at that time, you had to do everything manually. Everything was like character by character. There was no programs to build a website for you and all this kind of stuff. No HostGator and all these things that they have now. What's the main thing?
I'm thinking way back, like PageMill,
But now you got WordPress and all that. I mean, there was none of that kind of stuff. There was none of that automatic built just stuff. There was just everything was like one character at a time, And you had to type it in, literally. And so, I went ahead and learned it because I was suspicious that this guy was trying to use us, which he was. And so I found out how to register the site, and I registered my name and everything, Embase, and all this kind of stuff. And so I was the reason why I'm so prominent in Google search engines and stuff like that is because I was there before the search engine. I mean, when they started up, we were already there, so I didn't have to submit my stuff to search engines and all this kind of stuff because it was always there. And I just kept it going. Sort of like Five Elements. I started Five Elements in 81 and it just never stopped, That was my thing, because my motto was Duke Ellington, the Art Ensemble, Miles Davis, Modern Jazz Quartet, all these groups, Sun Ra, that lasted for decades, and they had these almost like dynasties and things like that. And so very early on, I thought, okay, when you do something, stick with it and let it, it's about longevity. It's not about hit records like Janis Jackson and Prince, that's not what our business is about. It's about longevity. I mean, I remember a guy asking Miles Davis, said, man, you're living like a king and you never had one hit record. I don't understand that. And I was like, he doesn't understand the concept, because with Miles, it was more about longevity and the body of all of his work. And it still had value because of the type of work he was doing. It's not like a hit record that was only a hit in 56 and that's it, And so, I learned this very early from watching those guys. That's my favorite thing, is watching people. And so, I tried to use that as my methodology. I said, okay, it's about longevity. It's about establishing yourself and establishing a principle and sticking with it, not going off and doing a million different things and stuff like that. So that's what I tried to do. And even when I got into the internet, I tried to do it there too. So then without saying anything, people associate things with you just because it's been there for so long.
Right.
You don't really have to say anything. So, I guess you're doing that with, your work and your site and everything. It's the same kind of thing.
We actually have more traffic than Downbeat on the web. They have more readers because of their print, but we have more traffic and people are always shocked at that. And I go, well, it's the Great Wall of China principle. I put one brick after another and I didn't stop. And now we have the Great Wall of China, So I learned that analogy from a drummer once. A drummer who had been a bricklayer as a kid, and he went to China and he saw the Great Wall of China. And at first he couldn't believe his eyes. He was like, I can't believe how big this thing is. And then he realized, oh, wait a minute. It's just, they just put one brick on top of another and they didn't stop. So on this mbase.net, I'm looking at it and this is great. So you've got for people that want to get deeper into music, for musicians, you've got classes, instructional stuff. This is great.
For years, I've been doing workshops and clinics and stuff like that. And then somebody had been trying to convince me for a long time that I should put it online because I could reach, the reach would be far greater than the people who would just come to the workshop, people in Australia. We had one guy who you know, registered from Kathmandu and stuff like this. I've never been to these places, you know. So it's like no way you can reach all these places. And so I started to do it, and then we got such positive response from people. I mean, one guy just registered just yesterday, told me that, you know, the site has changed his life. That's what he said. You know, he sent me an email. He said, man, this has changed my life. All this stuff in one place, you know, it's like, you know. And so, you know, but this obviously this is somebody who's really into the music in the first place, you know. But
sure.
But yeah, you know, I mean, people, you know, they hunger, especially on the internet. The internet can be very surface, as you know. You know, it can be very people posting, you know, their cats playing piano and all kinds of stuff like this, you know. So it can be very, very light, you know, and information light and very trivial. There's a lot of sensationalism, and, you know, it's sort of a lot of stuff that used to be in the National Enquirer and all that kind of stuff. That kind of stuff is on the internet a lot, you know. And
right,
that's the
kind
of thing that gets the most views on YouTube and all this kind of stuff, sensationalist stuff. And stuff that's, like, information-rich that you have to go kind of deep in, that's harder to find, you know. I mean, because you have to wade through all the other stuff to get there. And it's, you know, it's, stuff is usually not that deep because, you know, it's just people are just posting what I call clickbait stuff to get people to click on. I mean,
right.
It might be pictures of naked people or whatever, you know. And so, you know, it's rare to come up to a site that really has some real information on it in a certain area, you know, because that's not going to attract masses of people. And people are trying to monetize this thing. It's a big commercial thing, as you know, and everybody's trying to make money and everything. So, you know, I just wanted to do something that was another corner that was different than that. So it's just like what I do in my life, basically, because we, you know.
Yeah, that's how this looks. It just looks like it's you're using the internet. You're extending yourself to places that maybe you physically will never get to. And, you know, we're kind of spoiled. You know, you grew up in Chicago. You got to go hear Von Freeman. I got to see Cecil Taylor rehearse for 8 hours once. You know, I mean, when I lived in New York. I mean, these are experiences that, you know, you can't have in, you know, the Philippines or in Guatemala. You know, Cecil Taylor's not rehearsing this band in Guatemala. And that's never going to happen. So, and there's things that you can learn from witnessing these things and putting all this on video for people. It must be amazing for a musician to stumble on this. So for people that are interested in this, it's m-bass.net. And I'm looking at it. I'm going to be getting the one element of one as soon as we're off the phone. I got to watch this thing. Wow.
You'll be interested in that one.
Oh, I bet. Do you ever screen it? Like, I mean, I know you don't need any more projects, you know, but it would be neat to have screenings with audiences where a bunch of people can get together and watch this together.
We do. There's two DVDs. I mean, there's two documentaries on there, video documentaries. One is a very early thing that a woman did who was a student. It's called Black Science. And that you can just watch for free. That's another, you know, you search around under the menus and you'll see videos and stuff like that. But that's another one that you can just see right now, you know. And that's a shorter documentary where you remember I just told you about this trip in 1994 where we came out to the Bay Area, you know.
Right,
the very
right.
Trip. Well, she filmed that. She filmed us leaving New York. We drove across the country.
Really?
Yeah, she filmed this in the house when we were in Oakland, and then you know, so she filmed a little bit of that just to get the flavor of what that was with the early band during that period. That was 1994, and then this other woman took over from about 1996. That's the Cuba stuff you see and everything. And then she was around for like several years. She went all the way up until like 2000. So Von Freeman's on there, and I'm talking to Von Freeman. You know, he's on the tape, and I'm in his house talking to him and everything, and I have an interview online with me and Bunky Green, you know, where I'm talking to him and for a long time and, you know, about different things. So there's a lot of stuff on there. There's a lot of stuff. And I have a lot more that I'm going to put up, but I'm not trying to put it up all at once. I'm trying to, like, make sure it's in a good shape and everything and put it up. Because I have interviews. I mean, I have stuff, videos of me talking with Von, talking with Bunky, talking with Sam Rivers and different people. You know, I mean, I have a lot of stuff. You know, just like you know, Ornette and those other people. Everybody who's older has a lot of shit. I mean, that's just the way it is.
It's true. It just collects around you after the years go on. Well, I want to encourage everybody. You know, this is a perfect audience for you, Steve, because everyone listening to this has come to Jazz on the Tube because they like looking at jazz video. So I'm looking at this now, and really everybody, you must go to m-bass.net. You must check out what's here, and this is like a whole other world of stuff. I can't wait to get into it in detail. You know, I'm so glad, you know, it's been, I guess it's like 23 years since I saw you play live in Oakland, and, you know, it took me 23 years to finally talk to you, and a little bit on the phone at least, and I'm really glad that I had the opportunity. I did a lot of preparation for this interview, and that's why I'm encouraging people also to go to mbase.com and read all the interviews with Steve, and also definitely read that Charlie Parker essay. You know, if you're not a musician, maybe there are some things that'll go over your head. Don't worry about it. Just get what you can from it. It will, you know, as much as you appreciate Charlie Parker, this essay that Steve wrote is going to elevate that appreciation even higher. So it's a beautiful contribution, Steve, to understanding of music. It's really great.
I think even people who are not musicians can get something out of it. For example, one time John Coltrane Quartet was playing in Detroit, and Elvin Jones' niece came up to John, and I mean, she said this in an interview. That's why I know about it, you know. And so she said, you know, John, the band sounded great tonight. It was just wonderful. It made me feel this and that, you know. And so Coltrane said to her, he was like, well, what did you hear? I mean, you know, he's a very serious cat, right? And right. she couldn't really describe what she heard. And Coltrane said, don't be like these people who are out here just getting these very general opinions about the music. He said, try to go deeper. And so then he sat down with her and explained to her how to listen to a record. You know, for example,
he
said, when you listen to this record, try to go through and just focus on the bass and just what the bass is doing. Maybe give it a couple of listens and just focus on that, you know. Then maybe go through and focus on the drums, you know, focus on different instruments at a time on different listenings, you know, like isolate, you know, in your mind. And then, you know, start putting things together and everything. And he said, you'll find that you'll build an ability to be able to hear a lot more than these sort of general shapes that most lay people hear when they listen to music, you know. And so he was trying to get her to build her senses to the point where she could actually discriminate and hear the different conversations that are happening within the band and everything. And he actually sat down and explained this to her, you know. Mm. I mean, and I thought that was deep because, I mean, it was like he was trying to elevate the level at which people listen to the music, you know. And so one of the things I'm trying to do on the site, it's just that, and we encourage non-musicians to come there. And yeah, in the beginning, it's gonna, you know, be a bit of a mind twister, you know, and everything. But you know, you just hang in there, and after a while, you start noticing things that you didn't notice before. And you're like, wow, this music is more than what I thought it was. I thought it was just, you know, make my head bob, and that's it, you know. But I mean, there's more happening. There's actually dialogue and everything, you know. I encourage people. I have a lot of friends who are not musicians, but who hang out with us, and just by hanging out. And hearing us talk to each other and everything, they get a lot out of it, you know. I mean, they get a whole lot out of it, and they become much more educated listeners, you know, even though they've never...
I'm so glad you're saying this, because sometimes there's a big, unnecessary, artificial divide between audience members and musicians. Now, obviously, you're not going to be a musician unless you do the full process of becoming a musician. You know, there's a lot of things to learn, obviously, but you can get closer and closer all the time. Like, that's the beautiful thing about music. First of all, there's no barrier. There's nobody who's got a locked door. You know, if you can get the CD and play it over and over again, you can go as deep into it as anybody can. There's no locked door. And that advice that Coltrane gave that young lady, I mean, it seems simple, but if you actually do it, it'll bring you into another world. So, you know, you're right. There are a lot of people that love jazz, and they love the feeling, and they love the way it drives, but yeah, you can just play it over and say, okay, I'm going to follow the bass throughout the whole tune, see what he's doing. And then I'm going to follow the trumpet. I'm going to follow the drums. I've been doing this with Cuban percussion, because when I first heard it, believe it or not, the first rumba group I ever heard because of the way the tour worked was the Los Muñequitos. That was the first one I ever saw in live in reality. And I was stunned. You know, I couldn't figure out I loved what they were doing, but I couldn't figure out at all what they were doing. You know, it was so overwhelming. But then piece by piece, you know, you just go back and you listen to recordings and you chip away at it. And you're right. These things jump out at you. You start to see patterns. You start to understand what they're doing. And it just makes it better and better. and this is open to everybody, and then you're making it even more approachable on your site with this instruction. So it's a great thing. You know, one thing I always, maybe I don't know if you've ever thought about this. I'm sure you have it. It's the European approach we'll call it the African approach to music is just so different. You know, in Europe, everybody sits on a chair, and your hands are on your lap, and you know, maybe you don't even tap your foot. You know, it's almost like you're frozen in space. And then, in African music, you're on your feet. Everybody's appreciating it to the level they can. You know, some people are very sophisticated, and they can hear everything that's going on. Other people are just dancing, but everybody's in it. And to me, that's a better approach to music. But
the differences are really cultural differences, and they just amplified in music or art or whatever field you happen to be in. You know, but they're really cultural differences in terms of the way that people generally are. There's always exceptions, you know, but the way people generally are in each culture, you know. I mean, I'm using culture in a broad way because, you know, there are differences with different people in Europe too, and differences with different people in Africa. I mean, we can't just say these big broad areas like this, but I know what you're saying. You know, I know what you're referring to. And yes, generally speaking, there are huge differences in the, in fact, you might have named two opposite, you know, I mean, sensibilities, let's call it that, you know, I mean, in a lot of cases in the United States, you'll find various mixtures or admixtures of these different approaches within different communities and with different people. You mentioned something earlier where you talked about New Orleans and Haiti and all this kind of stuff, you know, and clave, you know, was something that I knew about before I even knew it was called clave, you know, I mean, because I heard it in the Meters and James Brown and all kinds of other music, you know,
right,
that I heard when I was younger, you know, it's there. It's real. I mean, it's there directly. It's not even like sort of hitting a little bit like it is with Charlie Parker's playing. It's there directly, you know. And so I talk about this a lot with Billy Hart. You know, we talk about the importance of this concept and how people don't recognize it as that in America because it's not written about that way. I guess that's the main thing, you know. I mean, but it's there, you know. It's been there all along, especially in African American forms. It's been there all along, and it's in all of the diaspora. It's not just in Cuba, but it's, you know, every place where they took slaves, you know. I mean, this thing survives in some form or another. This concept of the way the music is put together and the kind of way it relates in parts and puzzles and things like that, you know, the West African thing, because most of the slaves came from West Africa. You know, they didn't come from East Africa or North Africa or way in the South, something like that. The majority of them came from the Gold Coast. And so, you know, you have more of that sensibility in the music than in other places. People came from East Africa a lot later in this country and stuff like that, you know, so it's a different dynamic in places like Ethiopia and, you know, going further east, you know, so it's a whole different dynamic. But you know, we're all human. So, I mean, yeah, I think everybody has the ability to relate, you know, if they.
Yeah. And it's a great discovery that all these musics and Mario Bauza said it, I bet. He said, we're all speaking the same language. We just speak it with a different accent. when he was talking about, right? I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to. I got to tell you a funny story. I was on the subway in the Bronx this summer, and there was a young lady, you know, a very young mother, maybe even a teenager, but no more than her early 20s, and she had her little baby. And, you know, everybody teaches their baby how to clap at some point, right? She taught the baby a clave clap. And I'm like, holy, you know, it wasn't like she was some, you know, musicologist or some professor of, you know, African Latin studies. She was just a girl, you know, with her baby in the Bronx. And this is what occurred to her to teach how to clap, you know,
It starts with mother singing to us. That's, you know, that's usually the first music we've heard. You know, I mean, these lullabies and things like that, you know, it's very deep. You know, I mean, it's not, they've done whole studies on this whole thing of mothers singing to their children in different countries and stuff like that and the connection that they make and everything. And that's where it starts. In fact, it may start before that because, I mean, it may start when you're in the womb. And if you're around, like I've been around many people who were musicians or around me or presented music or something like that, and they got pregnant, you know, and I noticed a difference in their babies when they come out
than babies, you know, babies who are around a lot of live music while they're in the womb, you know, and experiencing a lot of vibrations and all this kind of stuff. To me, there's a difference in those kids who come out way more musical than other kids who don't have that, you know. So I think, go ahead, please. No, I just think that there's a lot of information that reaches us even before we get to the outside our mothers, you know.
That's well, I think of, you know, Ornette and his bands, you know, there's Ornette's son, DiNardo, and then Don Cherry and Nina Cherry, and then Charlie Hayden's kids were all musicians, Dewey Redman, you know, everyone in that band, I think, children became an excellent musician.
Yeah, Coltrane's kids, Jimmy Garrison's kids, you know, there's a long list.
You know? Yeah, well, it's. I think this site that you got here is a real, real contribution because it's sort of bridging, you know, it's bridging that gap between just hearing the music and starting to learn how it's put together. And then the more you know about how it's put together, the more you appreciate it too. And you also, the more you appreciate the efforts of our musicians, you know, sometimes you hear a record and it just seems to be coming out of the ether, but you know, behind it, there's a whole life of dedication. And, you know, in Steve's case, going to Ghana and being lost for 2.5 weeks, you know, trying to discover something, you know, that's the dues to try to take the music further. And I don't know, that's one of the reasons we do these interviews and why we have all these videos up on our site too, is just so people can see this is the fruit of human effort. And it's a beautiful, beautiful quest, and we're all part of it. That's the great thing, and you can go as deep into it as you want to. No, nobody's keeping you back. It's all there, and then with resources like what Steve's put up, it just gives you even more entry into it. So, Steve, we've been on a long time. I appreciate your indulgence with me and going on into all this wide variety of topics. So I just want to encourage everybody, definitely check out m-bass.com, read the essays, read the interviews. They're really interesting. And then go to this other thing, m-bass.net, and register, and you're going to see all these videos. And Steve's got a lot of trailers, so you can get a taste of everything for free. And then if something really piques your interest, like the video, like the documentary for me right now, then you can buy it. And so once you pay, then you can stream it live on your computer.
Yeah, you can stream it as long as you want. It's like YouTube, you know, you can stream it as long as you want. One thing I want to say is that connects everything is the last thing is just before I went to Cuba in 96, I came back and told my band, you know, that I just made this trip down there and I want to take them all down there and everything. So I was mentioning it to Coltrane's son, Robbie Coltrane, you know, who's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, you know, I want to go with you. You know, I was like, well, are you sure? Because he wasn't really in my band at the time, you know. And he was like, yeah, I want to go with you. I want to see what, you know, what this is, you know, blah, blah, blah. I want to go with you. So he went down there with me. I mean, a bunch of us went, but he was one of the ones that went down there. And he told me later that trip changed his life. I mean, changed my life, too. But he just said that the impact of that, you know, him and there was an MC I took down there, what people call a rapper. He went down there with me, too. And they both told me the same thing. They said, man, that trip altered my whole thing, you know. I mean, you know, it just changed. It just blew my mind, you know. And so, you know, just all the things that they got into. I don't know if you ever get a chance to talk to him about it one day, you know. But he mentioned that to me. And then he made me think, you know, again about his father and how he had never gone to these places. I mean, although he wanted to, you know. I mean, he didn't get a chance to go to some of these places and everything. And I just think about how just one trip like that can just, how big of an effect it can have on you. And so I always encourage people to travel and go to these places that they don't just talk about it, you know, go wherever you think about you want to go and just go there and experience it. Cause there's nothing like experiencing something. There's nothing like
exactly.
That.
And yeah, it might be a little rough around the edges the first couple of days or weeks, but that's the nature of travel. You know,
yeah.
I was in Mexico, I was in Oaxaca and I got super sick but I had been reading this book about a guy that had been traveling throughout the world, and it was like everything about the trip that he took was hard as hell. You know, it was just terrible. You know, pirates and this and that. And so I'm thinking, well, all right, I'm in bed sick for a couple of days. You know, I'm not being attacked by pirates on the open sea. You know, it's just that this is the way travel's been. But you know, Ornette went to Morocco up into the Atlas Mountains,
yeah.
and And I can tell you that had a he would still show those videos, you know, years later, and he always had them handy. And he went even to Africa. He went and went to a village and just started this big music commotion. Everybody started playing together, and that was a huge effect on him too. I guess, you know, that generation maybe just before that just wasn't so easy for people to get on a plane and go to Africa or, you know, go hang out somewhere.
There were guys, the early guys into it were people like, I mean, you know, Dizzy and them went on State Department tours and Louis Armstrong and all those cats, you know, but I mean, Randy Weston, Ornette, Don Cherry, there was a bass player named Ahmed, what was his name? Oh man, I can't remember his name. He played with Monk, but he was off into the stuff, you know. Yusef Atik was off into this, you know, I mean, those were the guys who I looked at early on, you know, I mean, their early research and their early things. And also there were African cats who came here, you know, you know, I mean, there was a guy from Ghana who came to Philadelphia and taught a whole bunch of African-American cats, a bunch of Ghanaian stuff and everything. And a lot of those guys ended up playing with Coltrane, you know. So, I mean, the main guy he taught, his name was Baba Fowler or something like this. But the guy who came here, Abway, I can't remember his name. But he came from Ghana in the 1950s to study here, and then he taught a whole bunch of African-American stuff. He's sort of like a more serious version of the cat that Tunji, the cat that Coltrane was friends with, you know. And so, you know, there's been guys, and then there was another guy named Ghanaba. His real name was Guy Warren, I think, and he's from Ghana. And I went to his house. He's way out in the bush. Some of the biggest mosquitoes I've ever seen, you know. And so he came here. He was friends with Max Roach and those guys early on in the 50s, we're talking about, you know. You know, I mean, there were early pioneers and all this kind of stuff and people who were interested in, you know, music from other places and all this. And so they set the stage for, like, those of us later who wanted to do the same investigation, and then we're setting the stage for somebody later on, you know. So it's like a chain. It keeps going.
Exactly. And that's one of the most beautiful things about this lineage passed down from person to person, and everybody adds their piece to it, and different people open doors that other people then can go through so they can maybe take it even further. And this whole process is, I think, is demonstrated really, really well in your life, you know. So Steve, thank you for the time. I really appreciate it. It's glad to meet you by telephone after all these years. Glad I saw you. When I saw you in Cuba, I said, okay, I gotta make the leap and get in touch. And I'm glad I did, and I hope to see you someday in person. I'm going back to Cuba early March. They're having a drum festival in Havana, and I thought, I got to see that. So
Yeah. Daphne Prieto told me he was going to be a part of that.
Oh, okay.
You know Daphne?
Yeah.
He lives in Miami now. He told me they invited him to do that, so he's going down there to do that.
Yeah. Oh, great. Great, yeah. I mean, a whole week of drumming in Havana, I can't imagine, you know, any better way to spend a week.
Yeah, I wish I could go. I'm going to be, you know, as you know from my schedule, I'm tied up, you know, but yeah, that should be great.
Well, I'm inspired to take some video, and I'll put it on YouTube. I'll send you an email so you can, you know, see a little slice of it at least.
Okay. I mean, did you see that little clip that I put up? It's on both my Facebook page and on my YouTube account. You know, just search.
Yeah. Were you in Matanzas just last month?
Yeah. It's just a small thing, you know.
Yeah, but it was cool, and I mailed it to my whole list, so a lot of people on this call probably saw it, and if you didn't see it, a lot of cool stuff going on in that. But one guy was playing the door.
Playing on the door to somebody's house.
That's Cuban, like whatever you can make a sound out of, there's, you know, make a sound out of it and join in. Yeah.
I put that up because the vibe of that, it says a lot, you know, about the place, you know, it sort of says, because we're right in the middle street, there's cars passing and stuff, you know, I mean, it's, you know.
Yep. Yeah. So we'll put that clip up again too on this page. And we'll also make sure we have a link to MBassNet, because everybody should look at this. If you love jazz or if you love music, creative music, and want to get deeper into it, don't be intimidated by the technical aspects. A lot of it, if it's explained to you, you'll grasp it, you know, and then you'll just take it deeper. And that's the beautiful thing about music is endless. You know, there's no way to even begin to get to the end, and it's all rich every step of the way. So
it's just a language, though. I mean, if you just think of it like that, a lot of things become simpler. If you think of it like it's a language and there's this dialogue that's happening and all this kind of stuff, you know, and stop thinking about music as if it's this alien thing, you know, you know, some out of space.
Yeah, language. Yeah. Yeah, that basic orientation would make a huge difference. Well, thanks, Steve. Thanks again. And I'm going to send you some stuff via email that you might find interesting and appreciate it again. Appreciate the time.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.